Good morning. I think we'll get started. We have a lot to cover today, and I'd like to finish a little earlier than it says on the schedule at 10 o'clock. My name is Naomi Bach. I'm from the Global AIDS Program at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in the United States, and my co-chair for this session is Dr. Vera Lemaine, who is the state agency TB and lung disease controller for Latvia and also director of their international training center. It's really exciting to be holding this symposium on infection control at a time when TB infection control is actually gaining recognition internationally as a key component of TB control. Many people in this room and most of the speakers who you will hear this morning have been working for years for this problem and its potential solutions to be recognized. The issues of institutional transmission of TB within healthcare settings, correctional facilities, and other congregate settings have been recognized since at least the mid-1980s, but very little has been promoted internationally for TB infection control. For myself, thinking why the international community has been so slow to recognize the problem, I decided that we have been using the wrong color scheme. The metaphor that many of us use when talking about institutional transmission of TB is that of a leaky spigot where new cases of TB are being spit out due to institutional transmission, whereas TB control is actually happening somewhere else. And if you think about how to progress the slides. Down here. Sorry about that. Okay, not quite set up. If you think about the color of a spigot and the water dripping out, it's actually blue, which psychologists will tell you is a very soothing color. But if instead we switch our metaphor to one that characterizes institutional transmission of tuberculosis in an era where immunocompromised persons become infected and progress rapidly to disease, and where many of them are now getting infected with drug-resistant TB that is difficult or impossible to treat, something more like an image of a match held to gasoline, is what comes to mind. So we end up with a red alert around the need for TB infection control. Now, this picture is a little frightening, and I'm not suggesting at all that our task is this daunting. And in fact, if you'll tolerate one more graphic from me, I think that we actually do have many interventions that have been proven to be effective in industrialized countries and for which adaptations have been proposed that could be worked that could work in settings with fewer resources. And in fact, our presentations today will cover many, but not all of these, as there are even more parts to the solving the puzzle of infection control that I've laid out here. But our first two speakers will talk about actually documenting the issue of institutional transmission to both healthcare workers and to patients within resource-limited settings. And then our other presenters will talk about at least some of administrative, environmental controls, laboratory controls, personal respiratory protection, and then proposals for new research. So I would like to go ahead and progress to our first speaker, Dr. Shona Dalal, who is recently completed her doctorate in epidemiology at the University of Michigan School of Public Health and is now an epidemiologic intelligence service officer in the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in the United States. She'll speak about work she's done with colleagues in Nairobi and the Division of TB Elimination in the CDC on tuberculosis among staff at a Nairobi hospital.
Good morning. So today I'll be talking about the risk of tuberculosis among staff at a Nairobi hospital. In March 2005, on World TB Day, a national newspaper in Kenya reported extremely high rates of TB amongst the staff of a large hospital, much higher than the already high national TB case rate. The Kenya national TB case rate in 2004 was reported to be 320 cases per 100,000 population. The case rates in the capital, Nairobi, were 2.5 times the national rates, and in 2004 were reported to be 830 per 100,000. It has been estimated that up to 60% of Nairobi's population live in slums, with the crowding that is a known risk factor for TB. Kenya has a generalized HIV epidemic, and current estimates indicate that nationally 6.7% of the adult population is infected with HIV. As in TB, the prevalence is higher in cities, with current estimates for Nairobi at 10%. Furthermore, it's estimated that approximately 60% of TB patients in Kenya have HIV infection. The hospital under discussion is a large 1,800-bed referral hospital in Nairobi, which caters to individuals from across East Africa. Overcrowding is common, and patients often have to share beds. In 2004, a total of over 4,500 cases of TB were diagnosed. There was concern in the hospital administration about the high staff TB case rate among the greater than 4,800 employees, as the workplace should be safe and protecting valuable human resources is important in resource-constrained settings. The hospital, the National Leprosy and Tuberculosis Program, and CDC together conducted an investigation into the problem. Our objectives were to describe tuberculosis rates and trends among staff at the hospital, to determine risk factors for TB disease, and to make recommendations to help control end tuberculosis transmission within the hospital. To meet our objectives, we reviewed the TB register and medical charts for information on staff TB cases, and we conducted a case control study to determine the hospital-associated risk factors for TB disease among staff. For the case control study, our case definition included all staff TB cases starting TB therapy at the hospital TB clinic from January 2003 through September 2005. All cases who could be traced were included, and a simple random sample derived from the current staff list was used to select controls. A structured interview was administered to both cases and controls. TB case rates observed among staff ranged from a low of 645 to a high of 1,115 cases per 100,000 over the last 5 years, with no apparent trend. These TB rates were at least twice the national rate. Out of the 215 TB patients recorded from 2001 to 2005, we were able to find and review 71 medical charts. We found that 46 or 65% had pulmonary TB. 24% of which had sputum specimens that were smear positive for acid fast bacilli. 43% were sputum smear negative. However, 33% did not have recorded results of a sputum smear, despite this being the standard means of diagnosing TB. The majority, or 66% shown in red, of staff TB cases did not have a recorded result for an HIV test. Of the remaining 34% who did have a recorded HIV test result, 86% were HIV positive and 14% were HIV negative. The demographics of participants in our case control study are as follows. The response rates for cases was 51% and 55% for sampled controls. Median age and sex were identical in both groups and were 37 years and 58% female, respectively. High-risk locations for transmission of M. tuberculosis were determined a priori and were defined as areas where TB patients received care. These included casualty or the emergency room and the outpatient TB clinic, where confirmed and suspected TB cases and other patients all shared the same crowded waiting areas which had limited ventilation. The inpatient medical wards had confirmed TB patients segregated into two rooms. There were large windows in these rooms, but they were often closed, particularly at night. Sputum specimens were also sometimes collected at the bedside of inpatients. This is a photograph of a typical room for TB patients in the medical wards. The outside windows would be closed at night, and the rooms were often crowded. In this case, there are two patients per bed on the right-hand side and one person on a mattress on the floor due to the shortage of beds. We used multivariate logistic regression to identify risk factors associated with a diagnosis of TB among staff. Five factors were statistically associated with TB disease and are the number of hours spent in a room with patients per day, working in a high-risk location, having HIV infection, and a housing situation. The two hospital-associated factors were number of hours spent in a room with patients per day and working in a high-risk location. The odds ratio for TB disease among staff associated with every 1 hour increase spent in a room with any patients per day was 1.3. after adjusting for working in a high-risk setting, HIV status, and housing situation. Specific occupations were not associated with TB disease. Rather, duration of exposure to patients is strongly associated across all occupations. Working in a high-risk location, defined as an area where TB patient care was provided and included casualty, the TB clinic, and inpatient medical wards, was associated with an odds ratio of 2.1 for TB disease among hospital staff. Other covariates not associated with the hospital were also significant in the multivariate logistic regression model. Having HIV infection was associated with an odds ratio of 29 among staff TB cases. The adjusted odds ratio for living in a slum was 4.7 and was 2.6 for those living in hospital employee low-income housing. From our investigation into TB transmission at this hospital, we found that the rates of among staff were very high. In 2005, the staff TB case rate was 869 cases per 100,000 population, 2.5 times the national average. Additionally, HIV status, a known risk factor for TB, was not recorded in the majority of medical records for staff TB cases. We noted several factors that showed statistically significant associations with increased odds of TB disease among hospital staff. Two of these were within the hospital and were the number of hours spent in a room with patients per day, regardless of occupation, and working in locations where TB patients received care. Others were having HIV infection and housing situation, specifically living in a slum or in hospital employee low-income housing. An additional important finding was that almost half of the staff in the control group reported that they did not know their HIV status. There were at least two limitations to this study. Data were self-reported in the case control study and could not be independently validated. There was the potential for bias if underreporting of HIV serostatus differed significantly between cases and controls. Our recommendations to decrease the potential for M. tuberculosis transmission within the hospital were consistent with new guidelines on TB infection control in the era of expanding HIV care and treatment published by the World Health Organization and CDC. They included considering an inexpensive covered outdoor waiting area for patients and casualty in the TB clinic to improve ventilation, to triage coughing patients to separate waiting areas, and providing expedited service for TB suspects to decrease their wait times in these crowded settings. Further, we recommended that a TB ward be considered to include infectious TB cases to separate them from other medical inpatients. For individuals suspected of having TB, we recommended that sputum collection be performed in a designated area away from patients and staff. As part of infection control training, all staff should be knowledgeable about signs and symptoms of TB to enable them to seek prompt diagnosis and treatment. HIV is the strongest known risk factor for progression to TB disease once infected. For their own protection and to receive appropriate care, it is crucial for staff working in hospitals in a country with a generalized HIV epidemic and high rates of TB to know their HIV status. Most importantly, for those working in rooms with patients and in high-risk locations for TB transmission. Interventions to increase acceptability of HIV testing in an environment that is supportive and confidential should be considered. Staff who are HIV infected should be offered optional reassignment away from areas of high TB exposure. Thank you. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much for great presentation. Now it's time to ask questions, please.
From Turkey first. Yes. I don't think this hospital with these data is have a more prevalent TB than the community. You told 830 for the Nairobi, and you told 869 for the hospital.
Right.
So something is missing here. I think the first question is, in that hospital, do they routinely use microscopy for each coughing patient? And do they have that opportunity to use for any case without they can pay or their social status or other things? Everyone, if coughing, if symptoms or something they think about TB, they can offer a microscope. Is that possible or not?
So let me start off with your first question about the numbers and the rates of TB among the community versus in the hospital setting staff. I think you're right that the numbers are very similar to those numbers that you've seen in Nairobi. However, I think the question is, should staff members of a hospital who have access to free healthcare have the same rates of TB as in the general community, given that the fact that the general community has high numbers of persons who are living in situations such as slums and crowded living conditions. So that's a question that I think, I don't think anyone would argue that 869 cases per 100,000 is a very high number to have among staff. And that's a number that should decrease and should perhaps be lower than that in the community. In terms of routinely using microscopy, I believe that they do routinely use microscopy. They have immunofluorescence, and in terms of payment, persons who are unable to pay for the pay for any exam within the hospital are, once they provide proof of that, are given free evaluations.
Can I get a data number about how many microscopy is done in that hospital yearly? So much TB patients, a big hospital, so.
Right. Well, I can tell you it used to be that they had about 15 tests that were done per day before this investigation. And since our results, those numbers have increased to 40 per day. So they had two staff trainings to increase staff awareness on TB and to ensure that people were requesting sputum specimens, which our results showed that not enough people were getting sputums done, but so those numbers have increased from 15 per day to about 40 per day.
Excuse me, I don't want to continue, but the one point is, my hospital has 1,000 patients in a TB patients in a hospital. Mm-hmm. We have 20 to 30,000 microscopies yearly and 150 daily. In that hospital, there should be a few hundred, 500, or 1,000 microscopy daily. So they are not doing microscopy. So the patients are undiagnosed. And
right.
One other point we must remember that these patients, maybe the patients you have worked with, also living in the slums. In studies in USA and others, we see that the patients in the hospital, if you categorize them, then CDTB patients are living in low-income settings and also coming from those groups of in the hospital. Okay?
That's quite possible, but I don't have information on that.
Thank you for this question and that showing that we should work on early detection and infection control measures in these settings. One question more, please.
From New Jersey, U.S. Very nice presentation. You know, a lot of us have struggled with this idea of how to set policies and procedures so that HIV-infected workers are removed. And I've frankly not sort of figured out a way to make that very effective. It's been difficult, at least at the site where I've worked. Do you have any follow-up in terms of how you've accomplished that? Just in a practical sense, has it worked? Are you able to do that at this site?
As far as I'm aware, what we had suggested was to have focus groups within the staff on where they would be comfortable to be tested perhaps considering self-testing for HIV. During our study, we asked patients, whether they were comfortable with the current location of the TB clinic, and most of them said, 93% of them said that if they were ever diagnosed with TB, they would seek treatment at this particular hospital, which gives them free care and free treatment. But they said that they were not comfortable, about 58% said they were not comfortable with the location of the TB clinic because it was too obvious. So there, and that is linked to the issue of stigma within their own community because of its association with HIV. So in terms of how to improve testing for HIV, I think the idea is to get places where they can have a confidential environment that's secure and in a location where they're comfortable to go and have it on their own. And the suggestion has been self-testing. But I think those answers have to come from the staff members themselves. So having focus groups or having discussions with where they are providing the input would probably be the best way to go.
Very nice to see follow-up data if you could do that.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next speaker is Gerald Friedland, professor of medicine, University of Yale, working in South Africa collaborating project that will speak about outbreak of multi-drug resistant among HIV patients in Durban, South Africa.
How do we get into the presentation?
Oh,
there's the keyboard. Okay.
But it's sort of not working. Oh, well, I'm sorry. That's because she stuck all these things in.
Oh, I see.
So keep going down, and when you get to the end, it'll disappear.
Whoa. We need another talk. Whoa. Okay. Good morning, friends and colleagues. Thank you for the organizers of the symposium for including our work. This work comes from a multinational, multi-institutional, and multi-generational group working in South Africa and the U.S. And I present this on behalf of my colleagues who are listed here, and there are substantial additional numbers as well. The outbreak, actually, that I'm talking about, I think, is not an outbreak, but really an endemic situation in rural South Africa, not in Durban. We've really just, I think, found what is likely to have been going on for a long time. Let me set the community setting for where the work has taken place. This is the map of South Africa. The province of KwaZulu-Natal is here. And the Mzinga district, where the work has taken place, is sort of centrally located in a rural area in KwaZulu-Natal, with about 2,000 square kilometers of area, and is the home to 250,000-300,000 traditional Zulu people who use a district hospital as a major source of health care. The area has a very high prevalence of tuberculosis, with a case rate of 800 to 1,000 per 100,000 individuals, and 70% to 80% of TB cases are HIV co-infected. Without antiretroviral therapy, the annual case fatality rate among co-infected individuals is 40%, and almost all of the time the cause of death is not really documented, and that's an important point that I'll come back to later. In addition, there's a very high HIV seroprevalence rate, with about 25% of the antenatal attendees being HIV positive. The medical setting is not unfamiliar to many of you in this room. It's a rural district hospital, 350 beds. There's male and female medical wards, each of about 40 beds, and male and female TB wards of about the same size. pediatric surgery, OBGYN, psychiatry are represented in different areas of the hospital, their outlying clinics, and very importantly to our work, and fortunately, there's a referral TB laboratory available to us 2.5 hours away in Durban. The TB DOTS program started in 1995 and follows the WHO South African TB guidelines. HIV program started by my colleague Tony Mall in 2000-2001, consists of an HIV clinic and home-based care. In 2004, government antiretroviral rollout began with, at this point, somewhere in the range of 1,400 individuals receiving antiretroviral therapy at this rural site. In addition, a TB-HIV integration operational research study has been going on in this site since 2002-2003. There's a typical TB ward in this hospital, one of the two. As you can see, there is light and ventilation, but as the previous speaker mentioned, at night the windows are closed. It's cold in South Africa at night much of the year, and whatever is accomplished by ventilation during the day is probably offset by what happens at night. The HIV-TB integration study, I'll spend a little bit of time describing. It's a demonstration project called Season Kolba, which is intended to treat co-infected patients simultaneously for active TB and HIV disease. And the components are strengthening the TB program, offering HIV VCT to TB patients, and then providing once daily antiretroviral therapy with DDI, 3TC, and efavirenz, given concurrently with the standard TB regimen, which is the four-drug regimen of INH, rifampin, afamutol, and pyrazinamide. Treatment support is provided daily by home family members with the assistance of community health care workers or DOT supporters. Patients are transitioned to self-administration of antiretroviral therapy at the completion of their TB treatment, and there's monitoring for TB and HIV outcomes. The outcomes of the Season Kolba study, as we have it now, are actually very favorable and very encouraging. This represents the HIV outcomes with a dramatic rise in CD4 count on antiretroviral therapy and gratifying fall in viral load over the course of a single year, with about 90% of individuals becoming non-detectable. The TB outcomes were similarly gratifying, with 80 to 85% of individuals completing their treatment course. Survival on antiretroviral therapy would have been somewhere in the range of perhaps 40%, and we were gratified to find that at the end of about a year, 90% of individuals had survived. However, we were concerned that there was somewhat more mortality than we thought might be present, and looked much more carefully at what people were dying of. So at that point in time, 119 individuals completed a year of therapy, and 14 had died, or 12%. 10 of them turned out to be due to suspected or confirmed multidrug-resistant tuberculosis, and 6 of those patients had XDR-TB. 4 patients had a second episode of TB after successful TB treatment completion, and all 4 died of XDR-TB. The rate of MDR in newly treated cases, and the study was 9%, about 4 times the rate that had been previously recorded in the province 5 years previously. This prompted a clinical and mycobacteriological survey of patients suspected with active tuberculosis or known to have active tuberculosis within the hospital. And there were 3 waves of survey that took place. The first was standard of care, and these are patients with treatment failure or retreatment cases, which is the standard in South Africa, which prompts culturing for tuberculosis. Newly infected individuals started on therapy do not get cultures. An inpatient survey of all patients on the TB wards at a single point in time, and all TB suspects, patients presenting to the district hospital with TB symptoms over a much longer period of time, and those were cough greater than 2 weeks, fever, weight loss, et cetera, and this is our prevalence sample, and all of this work was organized and implemented by our colleagues at the hospital led by Dr. Tony Mall. I want to point out that this work is in the process of being published in The Lancet, and call your attention to two other presentations today, which also summarize some of the work and provide more detail. On the website, you can actually get this article, Lancet, but it hasn't reached a publication in hard copy sometime this week or next week, which details the work that I'm going to present. These are our colleagues. And there's an oral presentation this afternoon by Neil Gandhi and the New Approaches to Diagnosis, Treatment, and Management session at room 343, and a poster presentation by Tony Mall simultaneously or concurrently, I should say, in room 352. So you can take your choice. These are the methods for these surveys. Drug susceptibility testing was performed on all cultures positive for MTB. Isoniazid, rifampin, ethambutol, streptomycin, cipro, and canna were the drugs that were tested or testable routinely in our referral laboratory. Chart review is performed for patients with strains resistant to all tested drugs, the XDR-TB cases. That included demographics, prior TB treatment, prior hospital admissions, HIV status, and survival. And molecular fingerprinting was available by RFLP or spalagotyping on all the XDR TB isolates. There were 1,539 patients in toto with isolates sent. 35%, or 544, were culture positive for M. tuberculosis. These are all three waves of testing. Of these 544 patients, 41%, or 221, were resistant to isoniazid and rifampin, qualifying for MDR-TB designation, and 53, or a quarter of the MDR patients and 10% of the culture-positive patients, were resistant to all tested drugs, qualifying for the XDR-TB designation. This is a group that represents the prevalence information with the clear denominator, group 3. And of these, there were 1,400 plus patients, and 475 were culture positive, or a third. 185 had MDR-TB, which is about 40% of the culture positives, and 13% of those who presented with a symptom of cough to the hospital had MDR-TB. 30 of these had XDR-TB, 16% of the MDR cases, 6% of the culture positives, and 2% of those coming to the hospital with cough. I want to go through some of the characteristics of these 53 patients with XDR-TB. They were young, about half male and female. And I just call your attention to the highlighted areas. Very importantly, more than half had not previously been treated for tuberculosis. So these were primary rather than acquired drug-resistant cases. An additional 14 or 28% had been previously treated, but there was documented information of treatment completion or cure. So only 14% had the likelihood of or the possibility of acquired drug resistance. In addition, two-thirds of the individuals have been hospitalized in the previous 2 years. 44 of the 53 had been HIV tested or had documentation of HIV test result, and all of them were HIV infected with a low CD4 count. Genotyping was performed on isolates. At this point, 46 isolates of the 53, and genotyping revealed that 39 of the 46, or 85% of the isolates, belong to or were genetically similar, belonging to the KZN or KwaZulu-Natal family of strains of M. tuberculosis, and these strains have been known to be circulating in the province for over a decade. Very strikingly and quite sadly, 52 of the 53 patients, 98%, have died. And the median survival from sputum collection to death was 16 days, with a wide range. There was no difference by all of the characteristics that we looked at in terms of duration of survival. I'm looking at this as a Kaplan-Meier plot. This represents days since sputum was collected and proportion surviving. You can see that within 30 days, 70% of the patients had died. So taking all this information together, we feel there is really very strong evidence for nosocomial transmission of XDR-TB. Most of the patients had no prior treatment or had completion and cure, and only 15% or so had previously unsuccessful treatment. Genotyping has revealed similar strains. 67% of the patients have been hospitalized in the prior 2 years. Not shown, but community contact tracing indicated that there were no additional cases of XDR among this population. So no evidence of community acquisition or that could be determined. And sadly, two healthcare workers died with confirmed XDR-TB. They were part of the cohort of patients that was described, and four of the workers died with suspected XDR-TB. A number of infection control practices and procedures have been put in place at the institution to try to strengthen infection control, recognizing that there's likely nosocomial transmission, and this conforms with the standard categories of infection control that we've learned about. So there has been staff information and training, cough hygiene instituted. A infection control officer has been appointed to monitor this. An isolation ward has been created for known XDR and MDR patients. And cultures and drug susceptibility testing is done on all tuberculosis cases from the first diagnosis, rather than waiting until they fail. And there's integration and communication between the TB and HIV programs, which was the genesis of our original study and where the observations had come from. Environmental changes that are possible to be done have taken place. So aerosolization procedures are performed outside. Ventilation and reconstruction of the institution is impossible, so natural air handling is the way in which this is handled, or all that is available, and as I mentioned, at night and within other facilities such as the HIV clinic, this is almost impossible. And there's been personal changes, so masks are worn when individuals are working on the TB boards, and when possible, when dealing with individuals who have active tuberculosis. And voluntary counseling and testing has been offered to all of the staff. There also have been political progress, I would say, in that this identification of XDR-TB has resulted, as you know, in a great deal of both medical and lay press attention. And the provincial government has strengthened the TB program with a lot of additional resources and staff. We're in the process of organizing prevalence surveys to try to determine the extent of this problem. I guess the question I would ask is, how do we demonstrate, or can we demonstrate, that these processes that have been put into place are actually effective? And the information is really quite scant and lacking, although these are that certainly make a good sense as strategies, and we affirm them and carry them out. Just to illustrate some of the problems, this is an HIV clinic. The staff with the patient who's coughing, everyone is wearing masks. I've tried to wear these masks, and many of you have, and if you have a big nose like me, it's a real problem to wear for more than 20 minutes or an hour. Some of you may be more fortunate and they're more comfortable. And there were attempts at ventilation, but these are really quite primitive, as you can see, and one wonders whether they're effective or not. This is a picture of the MDR, XDR-TB isolation ward, which was a psychiatric facility, and the number of patients who can be accommodated here are limited, but it is certainly a step forward. So what are the summary implication issues from what I've presented? Well, MDR and XDR-TB is dramatically more common than anticipated in rural KwaZulu-Natal. Excuse me. It's a significant cause of death among TB and HIV co-infected patients. evidence, I think, clearly points to nosocomial transmission of this really very lethal organism. Routine sputum culture and drug susceptibility testing allowed identification of MDR and XDR-TB, I think pointing very strongly to the need for improvement of even existing laboratory services so that this issue can be identified in other locations. Transmission of MDR and XDR-TB really must be addressed and further improve survival for HIV co-infected patients, and I really commend the conference organizers for organizing this session to emphasize that. But I would say quite ominously that in high prevalence areas, the success of both antiretroviral therapy and TB DOTS programs is really threatened by the presence of MDR and XDR-TB. Thank you.
Do we have some questions? Yes, Renee.
Thanks, Jerry, very much. That was an excellent presentation. You talk about the, I'm looking at the outpatient scenario where you're managing TB and HIV patients together, and this is something that's sort of being proposed and maybe a way of delivering services all over Africa. Can you talk a little bit more about what the procedures were, so the so-called administrative controls in that setting initially, and how that may be changed?
Right. Well, I think it's a very important point. We concentrate a lot on the inpatient setting, but we're pooling patients together who are HIV and TB co-infected in outpatient settings, and the outpatient settings are not themselves suitable often for reduction of risk of transmission. What's been done in this setting is, as far as possible, patients are outside waiting rather than inside within the facility. That's possible to do over substantial portions of the year, but not all of the time. There's cough and TB screening that goes on among the patients who are HIV infected who attend the clinic to try to identify those who might have active tuberculosis and they're removed. And there's encouragement of staff to determine their HIV status and redeployment of staff. The facility itself where the HIV clinic is a park home or a trailer at this point in time. A new clinic is being constructed, which will have proper infection control construction in an outdoor waiting area, air handling within the facility, and that's a little bit behind schedule, but that will, I think, help solve some of the problems, and that certainly is a function of both political will and environmental and administrative work. I think it's quite problematic, though, and as I showed you the picture with the masks, it's impractical to think that some of these facilities can just turn on and turn infection control practices that we think might be effective. I don't think that it's a reason for throwing out the entire TB-HIV integration strategy. I think it really means that we have to pay attention to this issue when we talk about integration, and probably the most important thing is screening for active tuberculosis among the HIV patients, and something that is not routinely done, but people are increasingly becoming aware of that.
Jerry, can you comment on the uptake of VCT, the extent to which VCT has mm-hmm. been taken up by the staff, particularly among the staff who are taking care of the patients with MDR-TB and XDR-TB?
Don't have complete information, and my colleague Tony Mall might want to comment on this. We do know of some healthcare workers who have been redeployed, found to be HIV positive. It's really done in a confidential manner, and I don't think full records are available at this point. An occupational officer and infection control officer exist now, and patients and staff can do this confidentially and also receive treatment confidentially because it takes place in the occupational clinic rather than in an HIV-TB specific clinic for staff. Some of the staff, we think, get their testing, and if they are positive, care at other institutions because of confidentiality issues. The general impression is that there's been an uptake of it, but not a complete one. Tony, would you like to make any comments? Okay. I think there is still substantial stigma, Renee, to answer your question, and that uptake is not complete despite this circumstance. But staff have not declined to work in these areas, which may be a good or a bad thing. I think the most important thing is to find out your HIV status, and under those circumstances, you would be redeployed to a low-risk area.
Linda Parsons, CDC Atlanta. Because not all facilities have access to culture, how did you find most of these cases were smear positive or smear negative, especially among the HIV co-infected?
Yeah. It's interesting. Among the XDR patients, the smear positivity rate was really quite high. It was close to 80%, 79%, whereas it's much lower. Sort of progressively goes down for MDR and then non-resistant tuberculosis. We're not entirely sure why. That may just be extent of disease because, as you saw, these patients died very quickly with far advanced disease. So at least the information that we have now among the XDR patients who were diagnosed who had pulmonary tuberculosis, the smear positivity rate was high. Could you use that alone to identify someone who has XDR-TB? I'm afraid not. But the clinicians at the hospital have come to appreciate some clinical, I think we all would appreciate this, but really become very much more cognizant of patients who are failing TB therapy as the ones who are at greatest risk for having XDR-TB. And sometimes even when that diagnosis is not made, those patients might be isolated until the culture comes back. So the short answer is sputum smears were more likely to be positive among the XDR patients.
Alistair Reid, HIV-TB advisor to UNAIDS. Thanks, Jerry. I'm impressed that you say that staff aren't expressing concerns about continuing to work in this environment. I think that both yours and the previous presentation show the risks that healthcare workers of all sorts are facing, and we're having increasing difficulties in retaining the health workforce. What do you think we really can do to reassure staff that it is safe to continue working in these environments? Because I've certainly heard many healthcare workers outside South Africa, but also very much in South Africa, expressing concerns about XDR-TB. I'd be interested to see what you think.
I think it's a real problem. I think one of the great vulnerabilities in this information is the effect that it might have on the healthcare staff, which is already quite stressed, and in most circumstances there is insufficient staff to start with. So I think this is one of the great problems, and when I mentioned can reverse the successes of TB and HIV rollout programs, I think one of the great concerns is actually loss of staff. I think the institution of appropriate infection control procedures and HIV testing and, very importantly, education of the staff is very important. There's still a lot of misinformation about what tuberculosis is and in hospital, a slideshow, a PowerPoint slideshow is prepared for the staff to really go through the detail, keep everybody very well informed, and that was sort of went around the entire hospital to try to actually provide the facts to the staff. Sometimes the fantasy, even as bad as the situation is, what people imagine is generally worse. And that, I think, was quite reassuring. But I think you put your finger on a very important problem and one of the reasons why we really have to pay enormous attention to this issue.
We'll take the last three questions of people standing and then we move on.
Thank you very much for your outstanding presentation. I'm Joost van der Meer from AIDS Foundation East West. What is your strategy towards the family members of MDR and XDR patients?
Yes. We've been fortunate in that there is contact tracing that is going on, and all of the identified XDR and MD patients now have contact tracing, so their families are evaluated. And I'm told that at this point in time, there are 10 family members have been identified as having MDR organisms. So active contact tracing is going on. There is a problem about what you do for prophylaxis, of course, for family members, and I think that's a very long discussion and probably not appropriate right now, but I think it's very problematic in terms of how one protects the family when you know someone in the household has been diagnosed. At this point in time, at least, identifying those who had active tuberculosis is going on in the household.
More comments than a question. Rod Escombe, Imperial College London. I just wanted to say that I've just completed a 3-year study evaluating the use of upper room ultraviolet light as an environmental control measure in Peru using guinea pigs exposed to ward air from an HIV-TB ward. And we've managed to show a 75% reduction in airborne TB transmission to those guinea pigs during that time. And it's a relatively low-cost, low-technology intervention that may well be useful in your ward as an adjunct to natural ventilation during the daytime. And when those windows get closed at night, you can turn on those ultraviolet lights. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. I'm not an expert in this area, and there are experts in the room, but my understanding is that the issue of how effective ultraviolet light might be in a setting such as this rather than an experimental setting with guinea pigs is really still quite controversial. And my understanding is air really needs to be exposed quite extensively to ultraviolet light and very close to it. And whether that can be accomplished in a setting like this, I think is quite problematic. Thank you.
Obviously a wonderful presentation. I was thinking about the background to the problem, as have many others, of course, and wondering what you could say about the rates of default in the background TB program, as well as the availability of drug susceptibility testing to the program prior to the recognition of this outbreak.
Yeah, without question, I think the original genesis of this problem was lack of completion of treatment. And also, interestingly, probably the use of some of the second-line drugs, not for the treatment of TB, but for the treatment of common respiratory infections, sepsis, which is quite common in South Africa, so the fluoroquinolones and aminoglycoside resistance might have been generated outside the TB programs and brought in. Yes, I think that's a problem. The completion rates in South Africa have been quite low, and that hopefully will improve. I think the problem that we're dealing now is it's a problem that's been generated by that, but now is accelerating on its own momentum because of transmission of these organisms in a very high prevalence HIV area.
Very briefly.
Yep. Jerry, I just can't let your comment on the UV go by.
Good.
I didn't know about Rod Escombe's data, but I'm very pleased to hear it. That really is a real-world setting because this is in room with patients and not in some sort of really experimental setting. So I'm thrilled to hear that. The issue with KwaZulu-Natal would be the high humidity, and that we probably don't know about as opposed to Lima, let's say.
Okay. Thank you.
Our next speaker is Dr. Vera Lemain, who I've introduced previously. She's the director of the State Agency for TB and Lung Disease of Latvia, where they have had a recognized MDR issue for a very long time, and we look forward to hearing her remarks.
Dear colleagues, I will present administrative controls for TB infection control in Latvia. Latvia is one of the Baltic countries, regained independence in 1991, and my presentation will be about administrative infection control in the main hospital in our program. After regained independence, tuberculosis rates increased very much in our country. At the same time, increase also rates with multi-drug resistant tuberculosis. You see it in green green line. Of course, especially in last year's increase in XDR-TB and HIV in recent years, also increasing in Latvia. Starting with in 1999, we have collaborating project with CDC to develop comprehensive infection control plan in State Agency of Tuberculosis Lung Disease. You see this hospital. It's hospital for 500 beds. And in 2000, we had already first infection control plan revised and updated on regular basis after that. And this infection control plan include administrative, environmental controls, and respiratory protection for healthcare workers. From hierarchy of infection control, we see that administrative controls is on top, and following with engineering and personal respiratory protection, and administrative controls have influence on health workers, patients, and facilities, decreasing the risk of tuberculosis infection. We use for developing our infection control measures literature you see on this slide, and mostly it was CDC guidelines for preventing the transmission of Mycobacterium tuberculosis in healthcare facilities issued in 1994, and you know that in 2005 we have already new guidelines and used new guidelines. Administrative controls in our hospital includes assignment of responsibilities, risk assessment, written infection control plan, which includes not only administrative measures but also engineering, environmental control measures, and personal respiratory protection. But today I will discuss administrative measures. For administrative measures, in infection control plan include installation procedures for patients, patient flow in facility, how to reduce cough-inducing procedures, as well staff and client education programs, screening program for healthcare workers, and the implementation and supervision of infection control plan. For responsibilities, there is on top there is an administrator for infection control program, and we don't have a special separate staff for these infection control measures, but there's assigned responsibilities to personnel working in the hospital to provide infection control measures, and administrative responsibilities on deputy director for hospital. Then infection control nurse and engineer who is following for engineering control measures, chief doctors and head nurses on tuberculosis departments, on in all departments in hospital, and all personnel also is responsible for providing infection control measures. This is the responsibilities on implementing, monitoring, enforcing, evaluating, and revising on routine basis. And this all is have very close linkage with tuberculosis diagnostics. For infection control measures, we have infection control plan. this plan include its written plan and include administrative, environmental, and personnel respiratory protection part. This written protocol describes early identification, diagnostic and evaluation of patients, isolation and treatment, isolation procedures and discontinuation protocols for patients, infectious patients, patients flow in hospital, transfer and discharge from hospital, how to maintain environmental controls, respiratory protection program, and of education part. For risk assessment, all hospital in general is high risk hospital because there is many tuberculosis patients for treatment. But within the hospital, we have three areas of risk of infection for TB. First is high risk part. This is the three tuberculosis departments, one multidrug resistant tuberculosis department, one for patients with high risk to having MDR-TB, then is bronchoscopy admission departments. For this part, there's administrative controls, engineering, and personal respiratory protection. High risk parts is several departments where non-TB patients stay, intensive care, consultation, and other diagnostic procedures provide, physical therapy. There is administrative and engineering controls. Medium risk parts is clinical laboratory, pharmacy, administration department and maintenance department, where is patients with tuberculosis not encountered. For these parts, only administrative controls is established. For infection control program, three goals we have. It's early detection of tuberculosis, early isolation of patient, and early treatment. On this slide, you see how separated is isolation rooms or isolation departments, because it's not separate rooms, but several rooms in each tuberculosis department. For MDR department, patients stay in isolation room until culture conversion. For high risk of MDR-TB, until DST results is ready or smear conversion to negative. In other departments, patients stay in isolation part until smear conversion to negative. Isolation departments is closed and patients not allowed go out without permission. Permission patient can get only when it's necessary to go for diagnostic procedures, and then patients wear surgical masks. For personnel who are working and going in isolation departments, they should wear respirators. For isolation procedure, first is patient education and sign informed consent. That means that all patients who fit for isolation, that means is smear positive or high suspects for tuberculosis or MDR-TB, is transferred to this department, and before that they sign informed consent that they understand why they should stay in isolation. Isolation department is used for smear positive cases, strongly suspected cases for TB, patients who become again positives, and patients who stay in this department should be provided drug sensitivity tests as soon as possible. ideally is to separate patient in this department as well according their disease. Because if we use conventional DST methods and we have high rate of MDR-TB, 10% among new patients, then waiting 2 or 3 months, it's difficult to isolate properly, not allowing distribute the drug-resistant tuberculosis. Therefore, according the patient status, it's better to isolate them in separate rooms. For monitoring infectiousness in interruption of isolation, patients is tested every 2 or 3 weeks after received treatment for tuberculosis. If they have 3 negative smears in consecutive days, they can be for them can be interrupted isolation. Of course, if there is a clinical improvement and there is evidence that patients is improving, then isolation is interrupted and patient can be discharged from hospital for ambulatory treatment or continued treatment in hospital in not isolation part of ward. Adherence to this isolation procedure, it's of course not easy for patient to stay in isolation room which is closed, and if we do this, we should provide them some benefits to stay in this isolation department. This is newspapers, magazines, hygiene kits delivery on request, radio, television, and phone to talk with relatives when they come to visit between the one window. They can discuss between themselves during visit. Patient flow from admission department, the physician who is responsible for admission department is doing first selection of patient for isolation. And these patients directly goes to isolation department. In TB ward, there is a second step for selecting patients for isolation department, and the chief of ward, physician working in the ward, head nurse is following the isolation rules to isolate this patient. When the patients go to examination rooms, they wearing surgical mask. For cough-inducing procedures, bronchoscopies, inhalation, this is restricted as much as possible and don't use for infectious patients, only in cases it's an emergency. For early diagnosis and appropriate treatment and isolation, we use for all patients, DST to Levinson-Jensen method, but it's slow and we should wait very long time. Therefore, we had in last years introduced Bagtec midget testing for DST, and there is two priorities. First priority is for patients with high risk for MDR-TB, and second priority for patients who is smear positives, and we should provide better infection control measures. Then we should wait only 1 or 2 weeks for DST results, two weeks. And the Inolipa test now is on study stage, but soon we will complete this study and hope to introduce for smear-positive patients is Inolipa test for direct specimens to detect patients with high risk for MDR-TB and improve infection control. Policies for healthcare workers is first of all training and education and re-education and follow-up for infection control measures, how this implemented in everyday routine work. During this course, they learn how infection control is organized and what is expected for healthcare workers within this infection control plan. Of course, personal respiratory protection and personal respiratory fit testing provided for them to understand how to wear, when, and why it's necessary. Counseling and screen healthcare workers to identify TB disease. It's provided yearly with medical questionnaire, chest X-ray yearly. It's not only for due TB, but also due another preventive measures. All healthcare workers should have a yearly chest X-ray. But if they have cough or sputum more than 3 weeks, they have medical examination for TB2. During these years, we registered all cases with tuberculosis registered among healthcare workers, and you can see on this graph that total registered cases in our hospital decreased during these years. We peak in 2000 and then decreasing, and last 2 years we do not register any new case. In conclusion, I would like to stress out that administrative infection control is the most important component in infection control plan. And it's possible in resources limited settings and high incidence of TB and NTR-TB, especially now with XTR-TB, it's very important to provide these administrative measures. Early detection, isolation, and early treatment. And TB infection control measures can effectively prevent nosocomial transmission of TB and MDR-TB to healthcare workers, and this includes not only administrative, this data I showed includes also environmental control and personal respiratory protection. This decreases incidence among healthcare workers. Thank you very much for attention.
Do we have any questions for Vera? Kevin?
Hi, thank you. Very nice talk. I'm wondering, it looked as if I heard this correctly, that you were keeping patients in isolation until they had 3 consecutive smears that were negative. And in my experience and reading of the literature, that can sometimes take months and months. What is your, do you have a very rapid conversion rate, or maybe your experience is different than ours? And then I have a follow-up question to it.
Thank you very much for this question. You are right. Not all patients convert so quickly. But we are happy that we can discharge these patients who convert quickly. And then we have left these who don't convert so fast. And of course, this is a problem for patients to stay a long time in isolation room, and we should work with them to encourage to stay in this isolation room to understand why they should stay.
And in follow-up to that, did I understand correctly that when visitors come, they're separated by a glass or?
Yes. Yes, that's right. They are separated. There is the doors closed, and there is a glass in the door, and they can have 2 phones, and they can discuss staying in both sides.
Okay. Well, I know the weather in Latvia is probably very different than Denver, where I had some of my experience, but I have absolutely no data, but I suspect that our immune systems respond to social interaction, and you know, I know patients really hate being in isolation for months and months, which we used to do as well. So just one suggestion is that we used to take patients outdoors and they could visit with family, you know, outdoors and not feel quite so confined. I think it's quite stressful on our patients to be, you know, basically in solitary confinement for months and months.
Yes, I can agree with this, but you saw in the slide our hospital, and there is not easy implement that the infectious patients goes out. If they goes out, they go through the whole hospital. And they have a big hall in end of department where they can go and have open windows for fresh air, but not for meetings with relatives, because then they should go through the ward. It's a problem, but it's a problem because the building is constructed in such a way.
I'm not sure I should ask this question to you, so I'm asking to anyone in the room who might know. And if no one knows, I would invite the people who tested the UV lights maybe to test this too. Like 10 years ago, there were no personal respirators, HEPA filter masks anywhere. Now they're sometimes available, but where they are available, it comes in like a donation, and then there's never enough. There's never enough to use them like the nature advised them to be used, like for 3 hours maximum or for 1 day maximum. So usually people either they use them like they should use them and then they don't have any left, or they use the one same mask for 10 days, for 1 month. So I wonder how high filtration, the high filtration mask still is after 10 days, after 1 month, and I wonder if anyone has ever tested this for different types of masks. Because in reality, this is what is happening.
I can answer that our personnel is wearing masks. And of course, we should observe all the time that they should wear masks and they should be compliant with respirators. But of course, it's not possible to wear long time. They go, works and comes out, but during stay in isolation, if they should wear all the day, it's not possible.
The question is, how long can a mask be used?
Yes,
not by the person, the mask itself.
Yes, mask itself, sometimes strips is broken. But the mask itself depends how long is used. And if the doctors is going one short time or a couple of short, they can wear quite a long time mask.
Paul, did you want to answer that in addition to what Vera said?
I'm Paul Jensen with CDC, and we've done some work in Russia, which isn't published yet, where we had folks use respirators for extended periods of time, record both the chronological time that they had the respirator and also the hours of usage of the respirator. And we used both the European certified respirators and the U.S. certified respirators. And what we found was two things. One is for extended periods of time of the, several hundred respirators, only one failed the certification test for filtration efficiency, and it just barely failed. So from the standpoint of the filter, you know, it's not going to be an issue. What Vira mentioned was exactly what the weak point of most respirators are, and that's the strap. What we found was about 20% of the people, when we refit tested them, failed the fit test. And the reason they failed the fit test is because that respirator wasn't tight enough against their face. We did find a few people that did innovative things, like kept tying knots on the strap. A couple people used shoelaces so that they could pull it up tighter, and that worked great. So, I don't know if there are any 3M representatives here or MSA or any of those other guys or gals, but what we need them to do is to make respirators that folks can use multiple times with better straps. And there's one caveat to that recommendation, and that is that, you know, you can reuse them for something like TB, which is an aerosol transmitted organism. Now, when you're dealing with SARS or avian flu, which is also contact, you know, scratch that recommendation.
One more question, Beth.
Thanks. Excellent presentation, and you obviously have a successful program. Can you comment a little bit on cost and how others might prioritize their interventions if they can't do the entire program as well as you did?
Costs for infection control? It's we did not count it exactly costs, but and I can't tell you properly how much costed the UV lamps. I just don't remember because we have in all isolation rooms UV lamps, which is working 24 hours per day. But for administrative controls, there's no cost. They should be administratively properly established and followed rules how to ensure these infection control programs. I think it's not big costs, maybe additional nurse, additional staff who are following in big hospital who is observing how it's going.
Dear colleagues, let me introduce next speaker, Grigory Volchenko. He's from Russia, head of Vladimir Oblast Dispensary, and he is going to talk about environmental controls for TB infection control in Russian Federation.
Thank you, Ira. I'm going to present information about the environmental controls and TB infection control in Russian Federation, and I'll use the example of Vladimir Oblast. And this work is in collaboration with WHO and CDC and local TB control program. Vladimir is located in the central European part of Russia, and this is a region which has population of 1.5 million people. The incidence notification rate of TB in civil sector for last year was 56.3 for 100,000 population. First of all, I would like to clarify what is environmental controls and how it relates to infection control. Are they equal or not? Engineering controls are limited to ventilation, UVGI, and room air cleaners. And environmental controls is a broader term. It includes not only engineering controls, but also other aspects of the environment, such as building, setting, facility. The goal of environmental controls is to decrease the risk of TB transmission among patients, personnel, and others inside the TB facility and in near proximity or outside the TB facility, by dilution, removal, and decontamination of infected air from high-risk zones, creating a safe and comfortable environment in the facility. Setting, air temperature and humidity and noise of the devices should be appropriate, and UVGI level. In 1999, CDC and WHO developed a set of consensus guidelines for limited resources countries. These guidelines are available in English, Russian, and Spanish. In addition, in 2005, the new guidelines was published by CDC and in Russian Federation. Also, there are official regulations about the hospitals and including TB hospitals, about the condition required and infection control. These regulations are quite fragmentary, but in common they comply with international recommendations. before implementation of the infection control program in Vladimir in 2002, the dispensary was located in the building originally constructed in the 19th century. This building contained rooms for up to 18 patients each, regardless of smear microscopy or DST results. So patients with sarcoidosis on steroids could stay in the same wards with the smear positive patients for weeks or months, and it was probably good for us that at that time we didn't have any HIV patients as we have now. Some staff used surgical masks, however, no one, even doctors and administrative persons, were respirators. Ventilation was solely through open windows, a limited number of unshielded UV lights were located in the building, but at that time we didn't have any tools to test the efficacy. No training was provided for staff at that time on infection control issues. And at that time was a strong belief that the only and real protection from getting active TB for healthcare worker is to have full stomach. Because of poor working conditions, without any effective infection control measures, the incidence of occupational TB in our institution was more than 20 times higher than for the residents for Vladimir City. In Vladimir at that time, the incidence rate was 45, and the incidence among healthcare workers of the TB dispensary was 1,080. So with the staff of 200 people for our TB institution, we have about 4 to 5 new TB cases among healthcare workers of our institution. There are some publications in the Russian Federation about the same estimations from Far East region and Samara published recently. We also found that the nurses and auxiliary staff are among the high-risk groups. More than 75% of all new TB cases came from these professions. And it was no surprise that TB control program experienced severe turnover and shortage of staff as a result of the high risk of getting active TB, the extremely poor working conditions, and because of very specific social profile of TB patients. Another side of this picture is the high default and interruption rate of for hospitalized TB patients. At that time it was 30 to 40%. These facts certainly were very strong factors for the increasingly high level of MDR TB, which reached 8 to 10% among new TB cases and 30% in retreatment TB cases in our region. Along with poor TB drug management practices, it also leads to emergence and spreading of MDR and XDR TB in such TB facilities. Actually, it's very difficult to assess or imagine the importance of this problem. However, I don't think that the cost to public health and society that results from the neglect of infection control can be overstated. Here you can see the picture of new building. The TB institution was moved in 2003. And it includes the appropriate conditions for the patients, including conditions for treatment and diagnostic procedures, both for inpatients and outpatients. Infection control training, including respirator fit testing, was initially conducted in 2002 by CDC specialists, and environmental control in Vladimir infection control program started from moving of this new dispensary to a new updated facility. 8 square meters per patient were provided for patients, and we were able to start to equip this building by the engineering devices, which included UVGI and UV fixtures, biosafety equipment for the labs, unshielded and shielded UV fixtures. You'll see the pictures in sputum collection booths. We are able now to follow this international recognized guidelines developed by CDC in 2003 on infection control and ventilation requirements for airborne infection isolation room. We maintain the continuous negative air pressure in relation to the air pressure in the corridor. We monitor and document it periodically. Ensure that rooms are well sealed by properly constructed windows, doors. We installed self-closing devices in all needed rooms, doors. We maintain the ventilation system that it directs its host air to the outside, and the installed UVGI devices both inside the rooms and in exhaust ducts of the ventilation system. This is the picture of the bacteriology lab on the first floor of the TB dispensary. And it was designed and constructed, reconstructed according to the both technology requirements and infection control purposes. And here in yellow, you can see the dirtiest and high-risk zone, transitional area with airlock, with positive air pressure there, and the clean zone in blue. And ventilation is designed and maintained in this way that in the dirtiest zone, the positive pressure lets air go from the corridor to the working rooms, and after that go to the ducts, UVGI decontamination, and outside the building. Excuse me. And in the clean zone, the air in the corridor is negative pressure, so goes from the rooms to the corridor and outside. Here you can see the smoke testing of the ventilation in the lab to test the ventilation efficiency. And the lab worker who works at the biosafety cabinet class 1 using the HEPA filter respirator. These are unique UV fixtures for Russia, designed with the support of CDC specialists and produced in Vladimir. And they allow both shielded in this mode and unshielded UV radiation for the wall room. This regimen is used for 24 hours, both in halls and patient rooms. And according to Russian requirements, we have to irradiate also the wall room for 20 minutes two times a day in this regimen shown here. And we are able now to test the efficiency of the UV irradiation using the UV meters. And we do it regularly. This is the sputum collection booth designed also with support of Paul Jensen CDC, and they installed on each patient's floor to collect the sputum. It contains the exhaust ventilator inside, which allows 24 times air exchange inside the booth. Also, it has a UV lamp inside to decontaminate the space inside without the patient, between the patients. On this picture, you can see testing procedure of UVGI decontamination in duct unit installed on the technological floor. The air goes from the high-risk zones, which are bacteriology lab, bronchoscopy unit, sputum collection booths, smear-positive floors. And at this procedure, ventilation engineer checks the ventilation airflow parameters and UVGI level inside the duct. This is a sampling procedure to test the efficiency of the decontamination in this unit. And we use special fast-growing strain to test how effective is the decontamination inside the duct by the UVGI. And it seems like it works perfectly. It's not expensive. It's affordable in our settings. And this is the first case for Russian Federation of installment of such facilities, such units. And we hope that it will be widely used in Russian Federation and other countries in such settings to decontaminate air. This is the PATOC unit. New technology is currently working on International Space Station, which uses electromagnetic field to kill mycobacteria and other germs. And actually, there is an idea to start to use this device in TB institutions in Russia. But you can see here the characteristics, and it's probably quite expensive. Its cost is up to $10,000 each. So we plan to assess this unit in our settings to find out is it appropriate usage or not, its efficiency and cost effectiveness. Here you can see the budget and cost of the infection control program. And what's important here is that the environmental controls are most costly component of infection control. The least expensive part of the environmental controls is UV. You can see it's only 4% of the total budget. And also important is that the local budget provided about 60% of the whole money, and we were also successful in finding, attracting international resources to fund our infection control program, which is quite expensive, and we still need $100,000 to complete the project next year. What typical problems of implementation of environmental controls we met? The first of all is lack of updated infection control knowledge and expertise among staff, healthcare workers, even ventilation specialists in Russia, epidemiologists, administrators, maintenance specialists. And what can be done is education and using of international guidelines and expertise support from the international organization. Very important in these settings like Russia with cold season is to have enough heating supply for the building to maintain effective ventilation, because it's actually cannot be used without enough heating of incoming air in cold season. And also the cost of maintenance and of equipment and continuation of the using of all equipment should be taken into account and included into the budget every year, and it can be substantial. Environmental controls include both engineering controls and other facility components. Both outside and inside the environment of TB facilities should be controlled. Prioritizing and cost effectiveness analysis should be done in the preparation phase of infection control program. Experienced personnel, special equipment, and separately allocated funding is needed for development, installation, maintenance, and monitoring of environmental controls on a regular basis. And finally, I would like to thank WHO and CDC and personally Paul Jensen for the expertise, support, and partial funding of the program. Thank you.
Thank you very much for excellent presentation. Please, now it's 5 minutes for questions.
Thank you for the presentation. I want to know your practices about microscopy, culture, susceptibility testing, and how fast you have susceptibility testing. And I know you have a high rate of MDR. Is it also present in your oblast? I don't know. Can you give some knowledge about your bacteriology?
We do all these procedures and DST on solid media, on Levenstein Jensen media, and the prevalence of MDR-TB among new cases is about 8%, and amount among retreatment cases is about 30%. It's about the same situation as in Latvia. So sputum microscopy for all inpatients for the hospital is done on regular basis every 4 weeks. of staying inside the hospital. And the discharge or transfer of patients is done according to the smear microscopy results. You have smear positive floor, smear negative floor, and so on. So every patient, even diagnostic patients without TB, is checked for sputum every 4 weeks.
As the discussion happened in previous presentation, for all smear positive cases, should we wait until the it gets negative? Because I think some patients are treated outpatient without hospitalization. So a patient can take a few weeks of treatment, and if you wait only for susceptible testing, maybe, not smear negativity.
Actually, we have the rule that the only after the conversion patient can be discharged or transferred to the smear negative floor. And we also try to keep patients with extensive disease and cavities longer, for longer time, in the smear positive floors. And only few patients who can be treated outpatiently without any contact, serious contact with relatives or families, they are treated outpatiently, but we still use DOT for that.
Thank you very much, Grigori, for an excellent presentation. I was lucky to visit your facility this year in July. I was really impressed by the immense work and progress that you are doing. You mentioned very high rates of TB among the facility staff before those measures were implemented. Do you see the same happening? Do you see less TB? Is it enough time already to have the data? Can you briefly say something about it?
In the 90s, before moving the hospital to new building, the average incidence notification rate for healthcare workers was 1,080. And after the moving hospital, average for four last years was 160. So it's still four times higher than for residents of Vladimir, but it decreased. And still the workers of high risk, but not so high as it was before.
Thank you very much, Grigori. Next speaker is Martin Hjapi. Are you here? No. But the next speaker is missing. Now, Noami Bok will tell about new tools and guidance for TB infection control.
Sorry, I haven't learned how to do this yet. Actually, I don't need a slide. I was just going to give you the websites for a couple of the documents that have already been mentioned this morning, and I don't know. That's good. And mention one that is about to go up on the website. So to keep this very brief and get us back on time, but also to be honest, there are not a lot of new tools yet to address TB infection control. We do think that they are going to coming now with the increased emphasis on this. However, we have a lot to do with implementing the tools that already exist and that I think in most settings in resource limited parts of the world have not been used at all. The basic document was published by WHO in 1999. It's at the top there, and then the CDC guidelines, which are at the bottom, updated version was published in 2005. Our speakers have already referred to that, but both of these give a lot of information about what can and should be done, and which we've shown, at least in some settings today, have been successful. In the middle, we have a new publication from WHO and CDC that is in press and about to be put up on this website, so don't be disappointed if it's not there today, but it will be within a few weeks. And basically, it's an addendum to the 1999 guidelines. As I said, there's not a lot of new science yet to inform new or different approaches, but this new publication basically lays out step by step how these facilities that for some reason have not been able to implement TB infection control should be able to do so. So there's actually a infection control plan there that can be adapted for different facilities. There's the training tools for the staff, there's the education materials for the patients, there's the monitoring tools for the plan, and they're, so they'll be right there and very easy to adapt for your institution and use. So I think that our goals in the next year or so, while we're waiting for new tools to be developed, are to implement those that we have and also to use our advocacy to get commitments from the ministries of health in the countries that are being affected, and also to use our advocacies with the multilateral donors who to date have not been very involved in TB infection control. And I think we just saw, Gregory, that the World Bank had given about 2% of your budget. Is that right? So, and that's probably more than it has done in most countries. To date, PEPFAR has not been funding TB infection control. The Global Fund has not been heavily involved. But I think they will be as we make the case more clearly that they've put so much money into treating people with HIV infection and saving these lives, and now they're all going to die from tuberculosis or drug-resistant tuberculosis. I don't think that's going to happen, but we have to make the case that these multilateral agencies should be supporting the infection control tools that we already have shown are effective and supporting also their monitoring and evaluation so we make sure that the programs implemented are actually quality programs. So that is all I want to say about new tools. And our last speaker is Ed Nardell, who is going to tell us what new tools we can look forward to in the 21st century, talking about appropriate research to address these issues. Well, you see that I'm barely making it here, so. Okay, and so now I launched. Just click that.
Good morning. Unexpectedly, actually have time to give a talk today. I thought we were going to run out of time. So what I've listed here first are the types of research needed, some of which we've had, and just categorized it as observational, and I should have included here also the outbreak reports, such as Jerry Friedland and others are presenting. But basically documenting transmission in hospitals, clinics, jails, prisons, etc. And also, as you'll see, communicable TB prevalence studies, which there are only very few of those, which I think really need to be done. Now, you know, I think we don't need to reinvent the wheel. I think any place that's not doing much in the way of infection control, if one looks, will find that, as was discussed in Vladimir and other places, that in fact there will be higher transmission among healthcare workers, and if we were able to study it among patients compared to the general population. However, I think there still is a role for these kinds of studies, particularly before and after, as we start actually implementing infection control, and Vladimir is a very good example. It's very important, as they've done, to show that you've been able to make a change. The next category, and I won't say an awful lot about this, is operational research. Implementation of the guidelines and the new tools that Naomi spoke of, the process, And such examples might be the time from admission to isolation, or the time the disputum is set off to the time that we have results and can act upon them. Now, new tools will impact on that. For example, in Estonia, we learned recently that they're actually already using the HINE test, which is a rapid test for MDR-TB, as a way to triage patients who have MDR-TB, presumably because they have rifampin resistance, into isolation. And certainly in a world where there are far too few places to isolate patients, the ability to determine who is likely to have MDR-TB is an enormous advantage. Interventional tests, and again, the work that we just heard from Vladimir is a good example. Testing traditional interventions such as building ventilation, ultraviolet filtration, and usually these are done in combination. I dare say it would be very difficult for our colleagues in Vladimir to be sure exactly which of the many interventions were done resulted in that lowering of infection rates, but it is useful to look before and after. And then I think we really do need some new interventions, and when they come along, they need to be tested, and I'll allude to what some of those might be in the future. Then I think there's a great lack of basic research in this area. There has been nothing really done in terms of understanding the aerobiology of TB for a very long time, perhaps since until recently, until the work of Richard Riley and colleagues in the early 50s, when this subject was one of the cutting-edge areas of research. But now, as you heard from a question by Rod Escambi, and there is other work being presented here at this meeting, there is now new work being done on basic mechanisms. And that can be thought of in work on human source factors. Kevin Fennelly's in the room, who's been studying source of transmission in particular, and the generation of infectious droplets. TB factors, strain differences. We have colleagues here in the room who are very interested to know whether, in fact, it is all MDR-TB acts the same, or whether there are, in fact, mutations that occur and that make some strains much more infectious than others. I think there is preliminary evidence that that's the case. Perhaps the best studied example of MDR transmission was that occurred with strain W in New York City between 85 and 92, and it's very clear that strain W, part of the Beijing strain, Beijing genotype, has a particular propensity to cause disease and to perpetuate itself all around the world, and some of those strains will turn up to be MDR, as occurred in New York. And finally, human host responses. For example, there's evidence now that that some strains are more likely to cause cavitation than other strains, and presumably it does that by inciting more delayed type hypersensitivity. So understanding the human response is all part of this mechanism of understanding basic transmission mechanism. Now, there obviously will need to be some research done that is MDR and XDR specific, and likewise HIV specific in this era where we are bringing these populations together, or they're coming together. So observational studies. Now, this is taken directly from the 1999 guidelines for middle and low income countries, and I'm not going to go through it. I just wanted to again point out that there is actually a fairly large body of observational studies looking at healthcare workers, more infection depending on how long people have worked in the healthcare industry, and also quite a bit of work among medical students comparing them to similar students in other fields, where it can be shown that in the preclinical and clinical years there's a stepwise increase in infection. And again, I mention these not to say that I would encourage you to think about doing these. Healthcare workers, in addition to being needing protection, also provide, particularly younger students, provide an opportunity to try and understand what's happening in the hospital if they can be tested. Now, testing We've always thought of this in terms of skin testing, and not only is this not done commonly in many developing countries, but as you know, the results are often confounded by the impact of BCG, as well as by community transmission. And as you all know, there are now several new tools available, particularly the gamma interferon release assays, which will allow us to study, if the resources are there, students and other workers in hospitals independently of BCG effect on reactivity to tuberculin antigen. So again, I think we'll be seeing future studies where these tests, and there already have been some done in Samara and elsewhere, where either the quantiferon gold test or the T-cell test have been used to document conversions. So there are limitations to these observational studies, and in particular, and this applies, I think, in particular to the KwaZulu-Natal data, trying to understand how much of this transmission occurs in the hospital versus in the community. And I think actually the KwaZulu-Natal data is useful in this regard because a sizable portion of the patients had linked genotype organisms, so presumably transmitted within that population, and yet also a sizable proportion, 50 or 60%, I don't remember, had never been hospitalized. So clearly those patients are not likely directly infected in the hospital, but in the community. Now, does that mean that somehow all we're talking about here today is not useful? Well, none of these interventions, I think, are going to be 100% effective. But the institution provides a place where we can implement administrative, environmental, and other controls that are not readily implemented in the community. So we've talked about skin test limitations and the potential for these other tests to help. Likewise, if one uses disease endpoints, disease as an endpoint rather than infection, clearly, we underestimate transmission in that regard because not all patients who develop infection go on to disease, although many do in the HIV setting. And then again, the site of transmission is uncertain. So I wanted to focus here on another type of study which there are far too few of, and again, I would encourage people working in this area to consider doing such a study. This comes from Lima, Peru, and was published a few years ago in Emerging Infectious Diseases, and really very straightforward, almost anyone could do it. 250 of 349 patients admitted to a female ward in a few years earlier were screened sequentially for TB with sputum, chest X-ray history, and physical examination. And this is a general medical ward, not a TB ward. And 40 patients, 16%, had positive cultures. 26 of the 40, 65%, were smear positive. 33%, 13 of the 40, were unsuspected. And 20 of the 40, 8 or 20% of the total, had MDR-TB. And of those, including 6 of those were unsuspected, and 3 of those were smear positive. Now, I say this, most of the talks you've heard so far have focused on the known patient with TB. And indeed, all of the things we talk about are very appropriate and are easily applied, and nothing's easy, or can be applied in the for the known or suspected patient. But it really is the unsuspected patient that is probably doing the most damage. This is a general medical ward. It's not different than the general medical ward that many of you are working and you can see that on this ward were smear positive MDR patients that were transmitting to the patient with diabetes or the patient with HIV who might be in the next bed. So we really need to, number one, document better how often this occurs in many different settings, and then to figure out how to screen for TB more effectively, to screen for MDR-TB with the new tests that are coming by, and to triage and isolate these patients before they do damage. So these are just some conclusions based on that study. And another thing to consider is not only do we need, obviously, better air disinfection in TB areas, but we need to think about air disinfection in general care areas, in waiting areas, in areas where patients congregate, because that's where indeed we were likely to be missing a lot of transmission. Now, again, I've alluded to operational research and some of the examples of what this might be like, and this is important in terms of implementing the guidelines. I will mention very briefly that at a recent meeting in Geneva, those of us with an interest in TB transmission were able to encourage WHO to and Stop TB Initiative to begin a sub-working group on infection control. It's not clear which working group it's going to be sub to, either MDR-TB, HIV, or DOTS expansion, but it is an opportunity to look at implementation. And one of the first things this group agreed is that we don't need new guidelines. We certainly want to make sure the guidelines that are published, as Naomi alluded to, are as up-to-date as possible, but we're not going to spend a lot of time worrying about guidelines. We want to worry about implementation. Right? There have been guidelines around for a long time, but in many parts of the world, these have not been implemented. Now, I'd like to just stop for a minute on basic transmission factors, and this is a slide which sort of captures the whole range of things, and beginning with the source, the coughing patient who generates particles into the air, and we again focus on the organism, their number, their viability, the effect of treatment, the effect of drug resistance on the infectiousness of organisms. There is a whole range of things which we don't know much about, beginning the effects of temperature and humidity and oxygen and concentrations and or oxygen damage and other environmental stresses on the organism. And then finally, the inhalation of the organism by the host, and the factors that determine whether infection takes place and ultimately progresses to another case of infectious TB. So these are the factors which we'd like to investigate. Unfortunately, there are now a couple of facilities in the world where this can be done. The idea for doing this began in the late 50s and early 60s by William Firth Wells, who had this concept of having a patient ward with colonies of guinea pigs located nearby where the air could be directed. As you can see from the wall here, their intention was actually to study ultraviolet irradiation, et cetera. That never got done. And I think the report, which you just heard briefly by Rod Escambi, may be the first redoing of that since this study many decades ago. This is Richard Riley in his youth, who actually was in charge of this study, and it's been published in many forms since then. You heard mention of Rod's facility in Lima. This is another facility in South Africa. It's been a collaborative effort of CDC, the leadership of Paul Jensen and Charles Wells, who are both here, myself at Harvard School of Public Health, and the research and institute in South Africa as well, and a medical research council under the direction of Karen Vyer. And it was at a hospital which has now changed names, but it is at a hospital which has now changed. It's no longer a Santa hospital. But this is what the facility looks like, and our collaborators here. And it is, again, a facility that allows us to house six patients with MDR-TB and to expose guinea pigs in a nearby exposure chamber to the air from that ward. And if you stop by on Friday in the 12:45 session, it's the poster session 18, Karen Vyer will have a poster showing the results of our first study, and what you see is that on repeated testing of the animals, there is a stepwise progression increase in infection rate of the guinea pigs over this 4-month period. So those who had the notion that MDR-TB wasn't very infectious need to pay attention to the fact that at least for guinea pigs, there was a remarkable degree of transmission of patients on therapy in the MDR ward. Many of them just started on therapy. Of course, we did select those patients for having factors associated with transmission, but nonetheless, so there will be many, many more studies, among them will be the infectivity of MDR with and without HIV, and the response to therapy. We hope to be able to tell you in a short while how long patients remain infectious and how well they respond to therapy. We will be testing ultraviolet as well, ventilation, filtration, and even masks on patients to determine how effective they are. And there are ways we can do that in this facility. We're going to look at clinical characteristics, and we hope to involve Kevin in this, Kevin Fennelly, whose work on source generation we've mentioned, to look and determine what factors are associated with infectiousness, what clinical factors are associated with infectiousness. We hope to study strain characteristics, the aerobiology of the organisms, and to look at environmental factors, for example, air pollution on TB transmission. This is just a schematic of our patient rooms and showing exposure to one of two guinea pig colonies where we can test interventions by directing the air from the rooms when the UV is on to one chamber on one day and to when the UV is off to the other chamber on other days. And after a period of time, these animals are only exposed when UV is on and this only when UV is off, and we can determine the efficacy of this intervention. Now, the last two slides are from our meeting in Geneva, where we listed some of the things we thought were important in terms of XDR research priorities and MDR research priorities. And again, we need to have surveys of consecutive admissions to determine how prevalent these entities are and unsuspected cases, smear status, symptoms, et cetera, analogous to, and this should be done in various parts of the world so we get a sense, and similar to the laboratory surveys that are done now for MDR-TB, we need to know from institutions, and not only hospitals, but from prisons, what the prevalence of unsuspected MDR-TB is. We need to evaluate various new technologies for infection control, for early triaging. We need to determine healthcare worker risks using interferon gamma release assays. We need to determine relative rates of transmission versus post-therapy MDR-TB in various settings. Remembering that prior treatment does not preclude reinfection as a cause. We oftentimes divide patients on whether or not they've been treated and assume that if they've never been treated before, then they have transmitted TB. But if they've been treated before, this probably represents acquired MDR. But in fact, obviously, many patients, particularly MDR patients, can also be infected by the airborne route, even though they've been treated before. This is a very important question, to determine how much is occurring in the community versus the institution, because that gives us an upper limit of what we can expect, and we have to think about if there are ways to cut down transmission in the community. Perhaps that is the last slide. I thought I had another one, but I think I'll stop there, and we'll have time for questions and be right on time.
Okay. Thank you, Ed. I appreciate your overview. I want to draw attention to your description of observational studies, because I do personally think this is a very powerful arena that we have underexploited. I call this opportunistic investigations. Nature designs these studies for us, and very often we go in and don't quite learn everything that is to be learned. If I may, I'm going to share a couple of very specific anecdotes with you and another area that I think needs to be incorporated more systematically into this. One was also in Peru. an investigation where the local persons in a hospital observed an excess rate of tuberculosis in their healthcare workers. They started implementing a whole series of procedures, and it was not until an outbreak investigation occurred that they uncovered that transmission was primarily limited to the laboratory with subsequent person-to-person transmission. And therefore, with those findings, they were able to target the interventions rather than implement infection control precautions everywhere, including in areas where they may not have been needed at an added cost. Second scenario, we heard about a year ago about Taiwan. They decided, for fear of SARS, to screen their healthcare worker population. Lo and behold, what did they find? 61 cases of tuberculosis. When they went back and investigated, again, if you accept it at face value, there's institutional transmission. But further observational rigorous study identified one ward where the odds of infection was between 4 and 8, if I remember correctly, and also respiratory therapy. Again, an opportunity to target those interventions without having to go through all 12 floors of the hospital. And then the last thing is, as we've heard throughout the morning, very often we march into these investigations and fail to bring with us the environmental engineers that can do the environmental assessment, and therefore we end up with incomplete data. So it's an exhortation for all of us as a community to really exploit these, investigate them rigorously, describe and report back, because that's what's going to tell us where exactly the problems are. And, you know, I find it very dissatisfying to say institutional transmission occurred. Yes, but where? And I think very often we can do a better job than that.
Thanks, Ken. I think those are good points, and I didn't want to dismiss at all the observational value of that. In fact, it's the first step in determining what the problem you're trying to solve. Lee?
Yeah. excuse me. Thank you, Ed. That was really very good, and congratulations on getting Riley Wells 2 off the ground, finally. I was interested, and you went very quickly over it, the guinea pigs that you did expose to MDR patients over 4 months, and I seem to remember vaguely in my memory somewhere that Riley was only able to get 50% infected. You had 80% over 4 months, so the question is does that mean these are more infectious perhaps than with Riley, which were not MDR, as I recall, or perhaps why were the other 20% not infected?
A very good question, Lee, and we don't know the answer exactly why we're seeing so much more transmission. There are a couple of factors to keep in mind. One is that Riley did have some drug-resistant cases, but in fact they were less transmissible than the drug-susceptible cases. Among the differences are the fact that Riley only counted those cases which went on to disease. At that early stage, he was afraid of being accused of looking at some sort of epiphenomenon. But the TB immunologists tell us that there's no reason in the world a guinea pig reacts to tuberculin if they have not been infected with the bug. So we've been counting all skin test reactions as positive, some of which don't go on to disease. So it depends what you want to define as infection. Secondly, we have very much higher flow rates in our facility than Riley did, and we may be achieving a greater capture. But I think the most important factor is I think that patients in Umfolaga province in South Africa are probably much sicker and much more infectious than patients in Baltimore, even in the 50s. And these are MDR patients who don't respond to therapy really promptly. Even over 4 months, some of the patients were still quite infectious. Yes, hi.
Madhu Pai, McGill University. Thanks, Ed. I'm really happy that you listed the importance of investigating new tools for studying conversions and transmission. As you are well aware, I'm aware of at least two studies where conversion rates with gamma interferon assays have been significantly higher than conversion rates with TST. Now, I find that encouraging as well as scary. If these tests are more sensitive at detecting conversions, I'm not talking about diagnosis, at detecting conversions, and I think you may be able to actually demonstrate that in your animal models, then we may have, for years and years, significantly underestimated nosocomial transmission by using TST. On the other hand, we may be just misinterpreting the data with IGRAs because none of us really know what an IGRA conversion is. If we just use a simplistic negative to positive, I fear we're going to see a significantly higher conversion rate with gamma interferon assays, and nobody really has any clue as to how much the gamma interferon has to go up before we say it's a conversion. And it has significant implications because if we use a gamma interferon assay, we may end up over-treating heck of a lot of people using 9 months of treatment that they don't need. On the other hand, if they are really infectious, then we need to probably be treating a lot more people than what we've been doing for the last decades.
Yeah, thank you, Madhu. I think the point you're making is that we really, in this era of gamma interferon assays, need to sort of redefine what infection is. And as I pointed out in a recent editorial, you know, there's also such a thing as transient tuberculosis infection. Not everyone who converts apparently stays positive, either by the skin test or by the gamma interferon release assays. And as I also alluded, our guinea pigs don't all stay positive. Some of them revert back to negative. So there's a lot of work to be done in this area. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ed. And I want to thank all of you for coming and for your contributions to the discussion. I want to thank all the speakers. And just mention one more thing. Outside on the table is a copy of a paper. There's going to be a special supplement to the Journal of Infectious Diseases on TB and HIV. And one of the topics covered is tuberculosis infection control. And in that paper, we have put together every resource we have found on tuberculosis infection control and their website. So it should give you some more access to resources on the table right out here. Thank you very much.